for another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is. And got quite a few things going. I guess everybody's adjusting to the new normal for however long it's going to last. And so rather than tell you about, you know, social distancing and all the rest of it, and you know how outraged some people are because gun stores are asked to close like other businesses, we're not going to go through all that. You know, you hear well enough of that everywhere else. So we're going to kind of stick with our format. You know, the first third of the show, we talk about political issues and gun issues. Second half of the show, we kind of talk about the few things around the gun culture. And the third part, which is my favorite, is questions and answers, because there's always something interesting and unexpected there. So, kind of looking at the corona madness, I live in one of the areas that everybody's under a stay-at-home order. And, you know, I don't know that they can order you to do shit. I mean, it's not martial law, so... And they do have the right for the public health to close certain businesses. I get that. But everything else, and of course, you know, there were the threats of the dire consequences of, you know, it could be a misdemeanor and you could be in jail for 6 months and all the rest of it. But then they say, well, but you can go out and buy groceries, and auto parts stores are open, as are auto mechanics and all these, you know, vital essential service type businesses. So... how they're going to essentially enforce all that and actually make anybody do anything is pretty ridiculous. So we'll see how it shakes out. I think it's all bluster, and I don't really think that much is going to come out of any kind of threats about people who are breaking the stay-at-home rule. One of the wonderful side effects, of course, of the corona madness is that's sucking the wind out of everything. Everything else... even the cat thinks so. It's sucking the wind out of everything else. So Joe Biden's campaign is essentially, you know, he can't get any traction on anything because nobody wants to listen to what he has to say about anything because everybody's preoccupied with the virus and with all the virus news. So it's going to be amazing, and it's going to be absolutely interesting to see how he tries to get his campaign back on track, and how people, you know, how are people going to see him as relevant? He's absent during this crisis. He you know, nobody can hear or see from him, and nobody really knows what he really thinks about anything. I think they're actually hiding him from the media because they don't want gaffes. They don't want him to look like an even bigger fool than he actually is. So the interesting part of this is, never thought that episode 65 of a podcast I started less than a year ago would be during a pandemic. So this is really interesting piece of news and history. And, you know, it's amazing how even the preppers seem to be... you know, kind of keeping a low profile. I would have thought that the goofy pastor in Arkansas who... he did put up a video hawking his book that he wrote, oh, years ago now, 2011 maybe, I think. And so he's trying to hawk more copies of his book about how to prepare your family. And he actually gave me a copy of this years ago. And I think I've thrown it away, but I remember the most laughable chapter was how to get your spouse on board. So there's going to be a lot of that stuff out happening. I did notice, though, that in the supermarket, all of these survival magazines are bought out. You know, they've actually got it used to be back in the day, there was only American Survival Guide, which... you know, it was really more of a gun-oriented book, kind of inspired by Mel Tappan, who was kind of the survival guns guru, you know. And he even wrote a book called Survival Guns, which actually is still pretty relevant. And we've talked about Tappan before. You know, he was a university... I think he was a professor at Stanford, like economics or something. Had some physical maladies and was kind of in a wheelchair at least towards the end of his life, and was up on a, you know, one of these self-sufficient ranches somewhere, and, you know, writing stuff and doing all that. Now, that was all good. But he in many ways inspired all this. But anyway, American Survival Guide was the magazine. You know, it went under probably 20 years ago, I guess. It went under when a lot of magazines went under, when the internet started coming out. And now there's three or four of them that are out now. Three of them that I can think of that I've seen. They're all basically garbage. I mean, they're all basically just trying to sell you fancy vehicles, you know, top-end stuff, you know. It's all about buying stuff, which is what prepping is. Prepping is about buying stuff. So that's those magazines are out there, but I noticed that every one of them now, I've been to two or three stores, and they're all sold out. So someone is picking that stuff up and reading it. I do have to say, though, that preppers are probably very disappointed that, you know, here it is, the thing they predicted, the pandemic, and this is all it is. I mean, crime has gone down. The world hasn't ended. There's no Walking Dead type doomsday scenario, nothing like that. Everything has just become, you know, frankly boring, and people are waiting to get back to work. We know the economy is going to recover. You know, yes, some waiters and waitresses and restaurant managers and all that have been hit pretty hard, as have been the airlines and probably cruise ships, the perfect incubator of any kind of germ or virus or foodborne sickness. There is not enough money to pay me to get on a cruise ship, to go anywhere. I don't care what it's seeing. You know, I mean, I don't care where it's going or what it's seeing. I'm not going to be there. But anyway, that industry's been hammered pretty hard too. But all that is going to bounce back. People will want to get back to normal. And, you know, summer's coming up. It's only the end of March now. So April, May, and they'll be playing baseball and doing all those things again. So to getting to more serious and frankly some of the most perplexing stuff I've ever seen. I saw this. The Marines are cutting tank battalions and attack aviation, because they want to be agile enough, which means, I guess, deploy quickly enough to confront a rising China. Which I thought, well, if you're going to confront China on any level, I think it's better to have as many tanks as you can spare and as many attack aircraft. Cutting back so you can get there faster doesn't seem to be very smart to me. And cutting combat power is never smart, even if you have what you believe to be more capable platforms. You know, the history of weapons development is just absolutely replete with examples of, hey, we've got this weapon, and it's really going to be a game changer, so we don't need nearly as many of them. That always turns into disaster on some level. It just always turns into disaster. That basically war, in many ways, is a numbers game. And quality is certainly very nice and great to have, but numbers also count for something. So when you reduce numbers, you're making a very, very risky judgment and doing a very, very risky thing, in my opinion. Okay, so while all of this is going on in the world, you know, most of us are stuck in the house, and most of us are kind of stuck. There are a lot of people who are still out, you know, just keeping the country going. And really hats off to them. And we're talking about people in transportation, public service, first responders, of course, and, you know, retail clerks, you know, people who are manning stores while people are going in and hoarding, buying toilet paper and Spam and all the rest of this stuff that everybody seems to need a lot more of these days. So, you know, there are a lot of people who are out there, but there are also a significant portion of people who are stuck at home. I mean, you're just stuck there. So I was kind of looking around saying, hey, what kind of projects are there to do to, you know, keep me busy for the next maybe week, maybe 2 weeks, however long this lasts? I mean, at a certain point, I'll run out of projects, but I looked at, you know, the biggest thing you can do, and if you're like me and you hand load, is get some hand loading out of the way. There's certain hand loading that's fun and certain hand loading that's not fun. The fun, I find, is weighing the powder charges and seeding the bullets and creating the finished product. The part that's not fun is sizing 5.56 brass and removing those horrible little military crimps. I'm at the point where I just may ditch military cases altogether, because military brass is a pain to deal with. And I mean, you wind up putting a lot of work just getting it trimmed down to size, getting that crimp removed. It's good quality stuff, there's no question about that, but that primer crimp is a real pain. And so it's almost worth, with 5.56, just to live without it. Just buy brass that doesn't have it, and use brass that doesn't have it. With 9mm, it's even worse, because it's frankly, it's not even really economical to hand load 9mm. 9mm has got, you know, you can buy the cheapo Tull ammo so cheap that, now if that all dries up, if all the cheap stuff dries up, then hey, guess what, you know, we'll be back to hand loading it. But the problem with hand loading it is, you almost have to buy good bullets with it, good jacketed bullets, because it operates at such a velocity. If you use lead bullets, my experience has been, you can get away with it if you load them at the minimum and try to keep the velocity down. But the minute the velocity gets up there, you get horrible leading problems, which in 9mm is just worse than any other. I suppose 357 Magnum is probably the worst, but 9mm is right up there. And it's probably just because you shoot a lot more. The volume you shoot out of a 9mm is a lot greater. But I find that the leading in there is a lot worse. So, you know, I don't even load those. But other things, there's all kinds of little calibers, little used calibers that I load on. And it's really a lot of single stage stuff. You go in 32 ACP. You know, I've got enough empty brass so that I may as well load it. I got some primers, I may as well use them. And I've got, and it's so economical on powder, you know, a couple of grains of powder and there you are. And for the few times I shoot it, because I do have some older guns in 32 ACP that, while the caliber isn't all that great, the guns are a lot of fun. So I go out after that, and I'll probably load 250 or 300 rounds of that. You know, and that's through a single stage press. That's not bad. That's pretty much less than a day's work, especially if you start with the brass already clean and you know, kind of go through the deal and take it through the deal of depriming, repriming, charging, and bullet seeding, and be pretty much good to go. So that's one. 38-40 was another caliber. I hand loaded up a couple hundred of those. Don't really have much use for it. So, you know, if you 200 or 300 rounds will last me, I'll say a year, but it probably lasts me 2 years. So we'll see. Other hand loading projects. I did the 40 rounds of 577 450 Martini Henry black powder loads. Yeah, those are fun to do. Those are just a lot of fun. I'd processed the brass ahead of time, so it was already primed, and of course it was a lot of fun measuring the black powder, putting it in there, putting in my cornmeal filler, and then seating the bullet on top of the lube cookie, they call it, or lube wad, or lube cookie. So that's the extent. I mean, it's there's a lot of fun going on out there. You can definitely have some very, very interesting things. Catching up on projects, you know, there's always a lot of other things too. You know, mounting a scope here and there on something or a sight, you know, and cleaning. Just sometimes general cleaning, because frankly, unless it's black powder or you're shooting surplus corrosive, a lot of times you can get away with not having to clean the gun every single time. And then you put it back in the rack, and then a year later you go, hey, why is this thing so dirty? Well, it's because you forgot to clean it, because they don't corrode the way they used to with corrosive ammunition or with black powder. Modern ammunition is very clean compared to those things. So there's always a lot of guns that you can clean and take care of. So those are some of the projects that can go on. Another project that's always big is just organizing. Somehow I wind up with bags of unsorted brass that I pick up when I'm shooting at the range. You know, I'll be picking up my brass, and somehow I never take all guns of one caliber. So I've got 45 mixed in with 30-06, and there's other things in there too. So, sorting that brass is something that just takes some time. And face it, we're all pretty busy. So, having some leisure time now, where you can definitely sort some brass and kind of get all this stuff organized, all those little doodads and geekaws that we use in hand loading, getting all those things organized as well as spare parts, it's a good thing. Some people are basically organized enough they can do all that all the time, and then there's the rest of us, and so this is a good time to catch up. In keeping with the stay-at-home projects, there's another area that always needs to be organized, and that is the morass of stuff that I can't seem to live without, that I always, wind up packing out to the range. Everything from spotting scopes to boxes of targets, and there's staplers, and there's this, that, and the other thing. There's always a little screwdriver kit. There's this, there's that. And, keeping all that stuff kind of organized is important, too, because it always tends to scatter and kind of bounce around and not be where it's supposed to be when it's needed. So, finding a good way to organize that, whether it's a good action packer, basically a plastic box that's got a good tight lid on it where you can put stuff in there and kind of keep it, or some other way that you organize it. Some people use range bags. I've never been a real fan of range bags. They always seem to collect empty brass and other things. And, they're okay for pistols, but, they kind of become a catch-all for all kinds of weird stuff. There's always target pasters and all kinds of stuff gets tossed in there. So, not a real range bag guy, but do like some of the other, as a matter of fact, thinking of range bags, just about 6 feet away from me is one of those old Packmeyer pistol boxes that was a birthday present decades ago from my parents. It's one of those ones where you showed up to the range, you opened the box, and it had the little kind of interior rack of five or six pistols, and you could put your spotting scope. I've got one of those, and it just lives on a shelf, and I think it keeps iPro and EarPro now. It's a storage bin for those, because I'm too sentimental to throw it away, and the minute I throw it away, I know I'll want it for something. I'll want to use it again. Although I have not seen one of those out on a range in years. I can't remember the last time I saw one of those out on a range. But if it's 30 years, that could very well be the case. So anyway, we got one of those things kicking around. Good time to inventory stuff and look at it. Over the years, I've collected up, various pieces of web gear and what in the Army we call TA-50. And, it's kind of good to go through some of that. Some of that I'll never use. Some of these, you see them for $2 or $3, weird, European surplus ammo pouches, and you figure, oh, that'll be kind of cool. I can put G3 mags in there or something. And you wind up never using them because the attachments are strange or something else. So you wind up with a box of or two of that kind of stuff that's good to go through and maybe pass off to kids or something so they can play with it. But there's always all that stuff that can be organized too. But I tend to have a lot of stuff. And so one of the things I got, and it's an early birthday present, is called a Bog Death Grip. And it's basically a tripod that you can shoot a rifle off of. I don't have a particular need for it, but I liked it just because it looks like it'll be fun to use. It looks like it'll be fun to use. And you can actually use it prone because the legs will lie out flat and, kind of like the good spotting scope tripods do now. And you can actually even use it with a spotting scope. So it's going to be a fun piece of equipment to play with, that's for sure. How well it'll hold up under, 30 caliber or 6.5 recoil, I don't know. I don't really know how it's going to work. But it's still in the box, and I'm going to go ahead and take it out and at least experiment with that for the next time I go down to the range, which is really fortunate because my range is not closed. Now, if you were shooting at a public indoor range, I bet those places, where I live, those places may be closed. But I do think that, our deal is a private club, and no one can really, like I said, it's not martial law, so they can't tell us not to do something, not to be there. It's a private club. I'm a member. I have access. So we'll see how that goes. But I think that we'll be pretty clear. And there's never a lot of people out there, so I'm not really worried about social distancing. And if I do, I guess I could fix bayonets or something. But there's never been a social distancing problem out there in the past, so I would not anticipate one coming up. So those are some of the stay-at-home things, and you know, the gun culture stuff has actually been pretty quiet. I mean, even the preppers are quiet. There are a few things going on here and there, but I don't see a whole lot of stuff happening that's gonna create a lot of bad things. I mean, I'm actually pretty positive. I mean, crime's down, people are behaving. I suppose if this went on for months, you would probably see some problems at stores where there's 20 packs of toilet paper and 50 people each want one, and some people want even more. So I can imagine you'd see some of that, but I don't really think that's happening. It looks like the supply chain is strained, but it's still going. So hopefully this will all end before that happens. But the gun culture stuff is quiet. I mean, there aren't any people talking about zombie apocalypses and how this is all going to, you know, turn everybody desperate, and, you know, all the preppers will have to, you know, get on top of the hill and defend themselves. No, that's really not talking about any of that at all. It is surprising that gun sales have increased because, as I said in the last podcast, you know, you can't shoot a virus. And, you know, if you need a gun for protection, the time to have it was a year ago, 6 months ago, and be practicing with it. You know, it's not like, hey, something bad is happening, so I'm just going to go buy a gun, and I'm just going to kind of take what they have there, which could be anything. Could be a really good deal, could be a really bad deal, you know, just don't know. And kind of go with that. I think people should be a little more thinking and use really good judgment before they make something, a choice, and embark on something as important as that. But it's apparently happening, so we'll see how it goes. But my estimate is that you know, the gun market, it's not going to be like after one of these incidences. It's going to bounce back to normal very quickly, probably within 2 weeks of things returning to normal. So we'll see how that happens, but it's been very quiet. One of the things that has been definitely interesting is, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts, a lot of gun podcasts, and, you know, when it comes to, you can always tell when a trainer is a guest on one of these, because the first thing they say is, well, you know, you should really consider buying a gun, but you got to get the training. You got to buy my training. And that's always what it comes down to. They say, you know, get training. And then it always comes down to where whoever's the host who's gotten this person on the deal, you know, kind of shills their training, you know, just basically trying to drum up business. Because, frankly, there's probably more trainers out there than you can shake a stick at. And female trainers, male trainers, they also want to train you in you know, pepper spray and knife combat and, you know, also some martial arts stuff. I mean, you can literally go crazy doing all this stuff. But one of the more interesting things is, you know, what is the recommended concealment gun? And a lot of them, for a long time, said, oh, Glock 19, because it holds a lot of rounds, and it's smaller than a regular Glock, and blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is, not all of us can carry a Glock 19 wherever we go. You just can't. Even back in the day, you know, there used to be things called black tie dinners where, you know, you can't really be carrying a big bulgy thing underneath your suit or your tuxedo. We don't do that much anymore as a society, but, you know, there are times when you have to do it. I mean, are you going to carry at a wedding? Are you going to carry, you know, at other places? Well, you might want to. That might be something that has to happen. But frankly, you know, you can't use these very large service style guns, and you have to go to something smaller. And, you know, the point that kind of gets pushed forward is, well, a gun's not doing any good if you leave it behind. If you're not carrying it, then what good is it? You know, if it's sitting back in your hotel room while you're at the event and then something bad happens, and something bad can happen anywhere. It can happen on the way there. It can happen afterwards. So consequently, everybody's looking at what is this idea, and they're searching for this ideal. And, you know, in many ways, it's the one you have with you is the best. But really, it's what function does it really going to do? And frankly, you know, it's really something just to cover your retreat. If you actually get into shooting, it's to stop someone who's coming at you to the point where they're going to harm you. They're coming, and you're trying to go somewhere else. You're not running towards them. You're trying to get away from them, or you're caught and you're stationary, and they're coming at you. So, you know, carrying the largest gun that you can makes sense, but carrying any gun when you're restricted on size is a very, very good thing also. And you know, I never laugh when somebody says I'm carrying a 32 and it's so deeply concealed nobody knows I have it, because frankly, most of the time it's the presentation of the gun will deter. The actual number of cases where shots are fired is comparatively small, so having a gun is a weapon itself. And I would never carry a fake gun or an empty gun, but a lot of times just the presence of a firearm in your hand can deter and de-escalate the situation to the point where, you know, you're going to get away safely. Some of the theories that, and where is all this going? Well, some of the theories out there that you have to have these high capacity super autos that are very, very small. You know, the gun companies are just falling all over themselves, attempting to make these things smaller and more high capacity and more powerful, you know, i.e. 9mm as opposed to 380 or something smaller. So consequently, you know, these guns, everything's a trade-off, and you're going to have a lot more recoil, and you're going to basically have a kind of a bulky little package if you insist on a lot of rounds. Single stacks actually made a comeback for a little bit. A Glock actually has made a couple of single stacks, you know, just concealability, because maybe 8 rounds of 9mm is better than, you know, 15 rounds of 9mm that's back in the hotel room. So very, very interesting. We'll see, kind of see where the training wheel kind of goes. But you hear it a lot on these podcasts of people pushing their own training. A lot of times, you know, you have to take a variety of opinions. And that's one of the things that I think everybody owes it to do, is don't just listen to one person and become a fanboy of one particular trainer or his school or his personality cult. Look at a lot of them, because, you know, you will find some that make more sense than others. And the last thing I'll talk about on this portion is the new hotness. What is the new hotness going to be? Well, I guarantee that Ruger, I bet within the year, maybe next SHOT Show, and I don't go to SHOT Show, I never get invited to anything like that, but Ruger, my prediction is Ruger will introduce a PC carbine in 5.7 by 28 to go along with their new 5.7 pistol. I just feel it coming. I just feel that they're going to, basically, their pistol is taking the wind. Not that there was that much wind. What little wind there was behind the FN 5.7, you know, their pistol has eclipsed that. It's a better, in my opinion, a better design. It's certainly about, it should be about half the cost. Although on GunBroker, they seem to be selling for just under $1,000, which is not insignificant. But I think once they get enough out into the market, once it cools off and they're no longer the new hotness, or they can ramp up production so that they're out there everywhere, you know, they're about half the cost of the FN pistol. And that's just, economics would say that that's going to merit its serious consideration, but it also appears to be a much better design. The FN design is, you know, 20 years old, which is really nothing in gun terms, but when you talk about another company having basically that much time to design or develop something that can be superior, well, there it is. And FN really hasn't updated their 5.7, so, you know, it is what it was 20 years ago. But I think you'll see a carbine out there, and what that carbine will do is the FN90, which is the carbine PS90, I don't know what they call that thing. Anyway, that thing they have, the one with the weird magazine up on top, and it's got kind of the ergonomic grip or whatever. And it's got some kind of funky sight rail, you know, that whole thing. Yeah, that whole thing is, I think those things are between $1,500 and $2,000. And, you know, they're cool. They're interesting. They're very cool. And a lot of people probably have them and like them. But I think Ruger will come out with its a bit more traditional 5.7 carbine. And I think it'll be modeled on the PC carbine in many ways. Kind of a little more traditional, and it'll be very effective, very accurate, and all that. Now, if High Point has brains, and that's a dangerous statement, because if High Point had brains, they wouldn't make High Points. But if High Point has brains, I would make a 5.7 High Point carbine that took the Ruger magazines, and I would try to beat them to the marketplace. And kind of undercut them, you know, go to the even cheaper mode. So somebody's going to look at saying, well, the FN one is very nice and very pricey. The Ruger one is nice and it's in the middle of the road, but the functional one that's very functional, is the High Point. And, you know, the High Point carbine was a very effective, you know, people still buy them and like them because they're comparatively inexpensive, reasonably reliable, you know, horribly ugly, but, you know, a lot of people kind of, to me, life's too short to shoot an ugly gun. That's just the way that is. But to some people who just are looking at strict function and economic cost, low cost, that's the ticket for them. So I would say that Ruger will introduce it, and if High Point is smart, they will introduce one also. So those will be the new hotness. Now, we have talked about politics and gun culture. We will now talk about my favorite part, questions and answers. And these have come to me, and I'm crinkling my paper here a little bit, but here's the first one. What is the deal with the 45 GAP? And GAP is Glock Auto Pistol. And, of course, the deal with it is it's a failure. That's the deal. But how it got that way is interesting. Essentially, 45 ACP is a big favorite in this country and in other parts of the world also. A lot of people like 45 caliber. Glock thought, and Glock does make a 45 ACP handgun, a couple different iterations of it, you know, compact and full size and. But they thought they could adapt their 40 caliber guns to essentially a shortened 45 caliber so they could use the same frame, kind of load it hot so they got 45 ACP ballistics out of it, and they would basically have the best of both worlds. They could use kind of existing platform, create a shorter 45 auto pistol cartridge, get the same performance, and they thought that people would buy that and like it. And the answer is they didn't, because it was a dumb idea. You can still find ammo for them occasionally in the bigger stores, and it's expensive. And that, you know, all those things contributed to people saying, why would I really want this? A lot of the people who like Glock handguns don't really care for 45 caliber. Right now they don't care for 40 caliber anymore. They're just going with the 9s. So it was a casualty. It was a mediocre idea at exactly the wrong time, and in a gun that is not as popular as some of their other models. So there you go. That's why the 45 GAP is now a footnote. The real sign that it was going to be a turd was when nobody else bothered to chamber or follow suit. You know, nobody else went down that road. They said, hey, you know, good luck, and watch Glock go down the road of self-destruction with that. And, you know, I don't even know if they, I'm sure they still have them in their line somewhere, but I don't think I've seen one, or as a matter of fact, I've never actually seen one on a range, and I don't think I've ever actually seen any empty brass on a range. So that'll tell you something right there. Okay, next question. And this is actually a very interesting one. Why didn't the SVT-40, FN-49, MAZ-49, Hakim, and AG-42B Jungmann have longer and more successful service lives? Now, what that question is asking is, why didn't those guns were all, by the way, full power battle rifles that were semi-automatic, that first generation of semi-automatics, which would have also included the M1 rifle. Trying to think of anything else. Yeah, kind of that kind of covers it. It was that first generation sweep of the rifles. And why didn't they last longer? Why didn't they do better? And I would say that the first thing is the SVT-40 would have had a longer and more useful life, but basically the German invasion kind of wrecked it. Some of the factory, the production of it was essentially disrupted. It was a good rifle. The problems I'll talk about with the other first generation rifles, but the SVT was basically never fully replaced the Mosin, and the production was disrupted. The factories that still could produce a lot of weapons and were far enough away that they weren't in danger of being overrun and occupied were all tooled up to produce Mosins. And so a decision was made that having Mosins that were ready to go was better than trying to re-establish a lot of the SVT production. So they just went to the Mosins just as a matter of practicality. The other deal was, I've heard that for the amount of effort, machining and other things that went into an SVT, that essentially you could make three Mosins. So you could make three, in the same amount of time and with the same amount of effort, you could make three rifles versus one. Now granted, they weren't semi-automatic, they weren't state-of-the-art, they were a 50-year-old design by that point, but, you know, they could put them out there, and it's better to have that than have no weapon. And the Soviet Union was really desperate for weapons, desperate for arms at this point. So, you know, numbers mattered. Numbers were more important than capabilities. So that's why the SVT basically kind of tanked. Now you'll hear that the SVT, you know, it was frail and the recruits were too stupid to maintain it and all the rest of it. And while there may be some truth into those, those aren't the real reasons it was taken out. The real reason was they could not produce them. The base, the industrial base that was producing them was essentially in danger. And, you know, the resources used to make it could make more of something else that was, while not quite as good, was good enough at that particular time. The FN-49, another excellent weapon. It served a lot in quite a few different places, but it basically the FAL, which came out less than 10 years later. I mean, the FAL came out in 54 or 55, and you just tell by the numbers, 49, 55, 6 years, and I don't think FN was particularly interested in producing an inferior model alongside their really good model that they really did want to sell, and what they felt was kind of a world standard, state of the art. Why would you make the old crummy car or the just good enough car when you've got a real thoroughbred in the showroom and that's really what you want to concentrate on, make and sell? So that's what they did, and they sold, they basically switched over to the superior design, and that's that. Same thing with the MAZ 49. I mean, it was, again, another one of these very good kind of rifles, but it was upgraded in 1956, and the French kind of stuck with it. Nobody else wanted one. I think they sold a few to Syria, and a few, you know, they peddled a few around the world where France still had some influence. post-World War II, but there was no real excitement for the Maz 49. Hakim and AG-42B, the Jungmann, they're basically the same gun. The Hakim's an 8mm. The AG-42, the Jungmann, is in 6.5. Very kind of cool rifles, but definitely not going to set the world on fire. And you got to remember, after 1945, especially in the Soviet Union, they were kind of looking at intermediate cartridges, assault rifles. Even the Europeans were looking the same way, and we kind of forced them into the 7.62x51 NATO. But, the Hakim and Jungmann, they're very long rifles. They feel, except for their semi-automatic action, they feel like something out of the late 19th or early 20th century. They just do, because they're long, they're wood, they're heavy, and they have the same kind of sights. But what really killed all those rifles was the fact that although they held 10 rounds and were semi-automatic, they basically loaded through the top with chargers and, stripper clips, we call them in this country as a slang term. But, it was kind of like the Mauser charging system. You couldn't reload them really fast. After the first 10 shots, hey, you're kind of reloading them, and while you do have that follow-up shot capability, it wasn't so great that it really put everybody in awe. People said, hey, this is better. But in a lot of cases, countries just stuck with the cheap bolt actions they had on hand or could get on the international market for nothing, because these rifles were good, but they weren't such a quantum leap that it justified the expense that it would take to get them. So, none of them really caught on, and they even tried to make the Hakim in an intermediate cartridge called a Rashid, which is a very interesting rifle, but it still handles pretty weird. And the other side of the coin is, post World War II, we start getting the AK. 47 is starting to be developed. It's eventually adopted. And that put literally millions of SKS rifles, fixed 10-shot magazine, intermediate cartridge rifles, kind of on the market. So a lot of countries that were, especially the ones under Soviet influence, hey, they could get those, And those even went to a few other places, too. And so there was a lot of competition. There was a lot of other ideas out there. And clearly, the world, at least in the Eastern Bloc, had started to move towards intermediate cartridges. And that's why these rifles went. They couldn't reload fast enough. Most of them have a detachable magazine, but no one was ever issued like 10 of these magazines. Because number one, they weigh a ton. And number two, they just didn't do that. You just loaded them the old-fashioned way with the magazine chargers. So they just didn't work out that well. They're very fun to shoot nowadays. If you can get a hold of any one of those, they're fun to shoot. They're great rifles, fun to shoot. But you can kind of see their limitations when you do that. If you're shooting it next to a bolt action, while they're better, they're not a quantum leap better. They're kind of a little bit better, but not a quantum leap better. I still think, though, one of the great what-ifs in history had been, what if somehow Britain had gotten a hold of an SVT-38 or an SVT-40 and decided, man, we could just convert this to 303, no problem. And would that have been something that replaced the Lee Enfield by the end of the war? Who knows? There were actually 303 British SVT-40s, but they were made for the Canadian civilian market after World War II. I think they were probably ex-Finnish rifles that had been reworked because, the 7.62x54 rimmed was absolutely unknown in the West. I mean, nobody made ammunition for it or anything. So it made sense that if you're going to sell these things commercially, especially as hunting rifles, that you would convert them into an ammunition that you could actually get. So that's that. All right. Next question is, what was the actual service life for the M1 rifle? And the question has got a second part. I've heard many different things that it was used up into the 1970s. Is this true? And the answer is, yes, it is true. Service life in U.S. service. Now, places like Korea and the Philippines, I'm not exactly sure when they phased their M1s out or how they passed them off to reserve forces or who still had them and used them. I'm not sure about any of that, really. And I don't know that anybody is, because if you try to make a declarative statement saying that, then the proof will show up that that's wrong. But the M1 rifle was adopted in 1936, but that doesn't mean that they showed up in any appreciable numbers until later. It took a long time to get them into production, and then after, I think it was 20,000. I think it was like 100,000 rifles into it. They went from the gas trap to the gas port, a different way of gassing the gun. It wasn't really that major of a modification. It did require a new barrel, you know, so, and a few other parts, a gas piston and all that. But, you know, it definitely had some teething problems, and they kind of nursed along. Plus, you know, the budgets were pretty paltry, even in the late 30s. When war was on the horizon, the budgets were kind of paltry. So, you know, they didn't really show up until 1942 in appreciable numbers. You know, the Marines invaded Guadalcanal primarily with 1903 Springfields. So, you know, that shows you that, you know, it's not like right after Pearl Harbor, everybody got a brand new M1. That just wasn't the case. But once production cranked up, it was really going. So you could call the service life started in 36, but it really didn't show up until, I would say, 42. And then it continued, obviously, through the Korean War. And in 1957, the M14 was adopted. But again, that's the same kind of deal. Just because it's adopted doesn't mean it's fielded fully. So, you know, it took years to replace the M1s with M14s. And actually, before that process was even complete, the M14 was kind of shoved aside, and the M16A1 was developed and brought in. And there were some units, some Army units, because the Army was a lot bigger then. Remember, we had the draft, and we had a huge presence in Europe, a huge presence in Korea. So there were units that went from the M1 to the M16, which is kind of cool when you think about it. They kind of skipped a whole generation of rifles there. But the M1 continued in National Guard use until, I think, 74, 75. I mean, the infamous incident was the Kent State shootings, where National Guard had M1 rifles. And you'll see through the CMP rifles predominantly, you'll see rifles that have, you know, early 70s replacement barrels on them. So definitely, I would say that 75, so you could look 36 to 75, you know, something like that. So darn near 40 years. And even if you cut a few years off of each one of those and say, well, maybe it's more like 1940 to 1970, that's still a good 30 years. So that was the M1 rifle. Now, I understand that M1Ds actually stayed in some units somewhere, and according to Scott Duff anyway, some were taken to Desert Storm vis-a-vis with reserve special forces troops that were mobilized and sent there. Whether that is true or not, I don't know. It could be, could very well be, because, you know, sometimes you just go with, if you've got it, you go. There's a lot of obsolete equipment hangs around a lot longer than you think. I told the story a few podcasts ago. In 1995, we turned in 1911 A1s. Now, most armchair commandos will say, no, Beretta was adopted in 84, which was essentially, or 85, whichever it was, which is essentially true. But that doesn't mean they were fielded everywhere. That doesn't mean that everybody had them immediately. Or it takes years, a lot of times, to introduce new things. So, yeah, the M1 rifle just was the same way. You know, it lingered around a lot longer than people actually suspected it did. Okay, next question. What do you think of lever guns for self-defense? Well, that's pretty interesting. First of all, nobody loves lever guns, probably more than me in some ways. I've always had them. I've always, from the time I first started shooting until the present day, there's always seems to be a lever action around, you know, sitting in the closet or whatever, or in the gun safe. So I really like them. I think they're very, very useful. I think they were an inspired design, both back then and still today. Still today. The things that made it great have not changed, which is fast handling, in most cases reasonably powerful, and it has a fairly good capacity. So all these things make it a good all-around gun. And for years, I mean, everybody, when I grew up, everybody had a 30-30. Every family had at least one that was the beginning deer rifle, did a lot of other things. You know, if you had a ranch, we lived on a ranch, you know, you had it because it could handle, you know, the chores. Anything you needed to have shot, it could shoot and kill. Whether it's a porcupine or whether it's a black bear, whatever it is, or if it's an injured animal or something, you know, you could, the 30-30 was just always there. It was always around. A very, very good design. You know, the other guns that kind of come back into vogue during, because of cowboy shooting and other things, have been the pistol caliber carbines. Very handy guns, even more capacity, improved ballistics on cartridges like 44-40, 38-40, 45 Colt, which was never chambered in one in the Old West, but is now, and even 44 Magnum, 38 Special, and 357 Magnum. Those kind of shine when they come out of a rifle barrel. They improve, the ballistics improve enough so that it's a definite improvement over the pistol. It's a definite leap over the pistol. So, you know, they're very, very good guns. Now, if you're trying to defend yourself against a, you know, crazy zombie drug cartel, yeah, you probably don't have the right gun. But for most things, especially defense inside a home, a saddle ring carbine makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. And they're not slouches. A 30-30 is not a slouch. A 45 Colt, a 44 Magnum, a 357 Magnum, 38-40, 44-40, all those coming out of a rifle barrel at home defense ranges are no slouches. And if you practice with it and get good with it, cycling that action, you have a very quick follow-up shot. And, you know, if you live in one of those occupied America where they won't let you have ARs and Mini 14s and all the other good things, you definitely could do a lot worse. I mean, they're very, very good guns to have. I would say that, you know, if there are better choices out there, there are more modern choices, but, you know, the lever action gun is pretty good, but it's not perfect. And one of the skills you have to learn is, you know, getting one of those leather butt cuff things that's got a few extra rounds so that, hey, if you fire twice and you get a slight pause because the bad guys are regrouping or whatever, hey, you got to top off that magazine. You got to be able to do that without necessarily looking down. You got to be able to pick the cartridge out and put it in that loading gate while you're still scanning and looking around for trouble. So it's got some stuff in there. There have been Gunsight and I think Thunder Ranch have each had courses where they use Old West guns. Mostly it's a vanity thing, I think. But, you know, it's out there. So, yes, they're reasonable, and especially if you don't want to buy something semi-automatic, they're probably the next best choice if you do not want a semi-automatic gun. You go to lever action. That's just where you got to go. Okay, and here's our last question. Why do you hate the term DMR, designated marksman, and designated marksman rifle? Why do I hate those terms? Well, because if you apply the definition to those things that we use today, then we never had snipers in World War I, World War II, Korea, and maybe just a little bit in Vietnam, because we tend to use the word sniper to define our high-end shooting capabilities, very elite force shooting capabilities. And nowadays that's Special Forces, Navy SEALs, Delta Force, you know, law enforcement snipers, kind of get laughed at by this high-end, the people who idolize the high-enders, because law enforcement basically shoots people at 200 yards and less, maybe even 100 yards and less. That's because that's what their mission is. That's what they do. So I think that, you know, if we were going to use this term DMR, I just think that it's kind of a joke. I mean, when you're hitting a shooting at a point target, you're shooting, you are a sniper. That's what you do. And you, maybe you and your gun can only hit something 350 yards away, but that's your mission. That's the tool you have, and that's what you are. You're a sniper. They had Viet Cong snipers in the Vietnam War who were using M1 carbines or SKSs and things like this, who had no optical sights on them whatsoever. So, you know, you can just take that for what it is. I mean, I don't really care for the term. I think they're snipers. If you want to talk about the very best versus the guys who are just kind of, you know, average and in conventional type units, well, that's an argument for another day, but they're all snipers. They're all snipers. A DMR is a sniper, just got a slightly different mission and probably a less precision piece of equipment built more for durability than precision. And the high-end guys, yeah, they do some fantastic things. You know, they can shoot people at incredible distances and do all kinds of these wonderful things. But the guys in the trenches, should we ever get into a major land combat situation again, these guys down in the trenches will definitely prove their worth, and you know, they will be known as the snipers. They'll basically be enough of them, and they will be effective enough so that they will be the when people think of snipers, they'll probably think more of these guys, the guys we now call DMR guys, as opposed to the very, very small, very elite, and extremely proficient, but not very numerous high-end guys that we think of now. Okay, that's it for this edition of Old School Guns. Remember to like us on whatever platform you're listening to us on. We live on Podbean, which is our hosting site, and you can always leave a comment there, leave a question, and you know, in these trying times, just keep your head up, stay busy, and think about how good the shooting sports are going to be this summer coming up. So until next time, this is Old School Guns, out.